This is John McMurray sitting with David Vincent, the official scorer for the Washington Nationals on May the 2nd, 2016 at his home in Centerville, Virginia. And David has been involved with scoring in professional baseball for 29 years and 12 with the Nationals. And I wondered, David, if you could explain how you got from there to here, so to speak.
When I was growing up, I played Little League like all my friends, and I wasn't very good. But the best thing that came out of Little League for me was I learned, for the first time, I learned how to keep score on a piece of paper. The woman who was the wife of the guy who was in charge of the Little League, I sat with her a couple of days, and she was keeping score for games, and I started watching, and she was telling me what she was doing. So I was 8, 9 years old, and I learned the first system of scoring. And of course, my system has probably changed 45 times since then, but you know, that's where it started. When I was in high school, I didn't play, but I was a stringer for the local newspaper. And after, it was both basketball and baseball, and after games, I would go around dinner time or right after dinner time, I'd go to the newspaper office and I'd talk to one of the sports writers and report facts of the game, and then they write the story, but I'd give them something that they could put a box score together in a story. And I used to get paid, now this is the late, mid to late 60s, and I was being paid $2 a game as a stringer for this local town newspaper, which was my first money in baseball. $2 a game, that you know, I make a couple of dollars more than that now, but you know. Anyway, when I got out of grad school and I moved to Johnson City, Tennessee, there was a local team there in the Appalachian League, the Johnson City Cardinals, and we used to go to games, and I got to know a couple of the staff people. And at that time, in 1980, in the early 1980s, 81, there was one guy in the press box, the local sports writer, who was the official scorer, and he also did public address, and he flipped switches to run the scoreboard. And one night I was asked by somebody, because at the time I was a college band director, and part of my duties during football season especially was doing a lot of public address stuff for the band. And so they asked me if I'd be the PA guy for them at the ballpark. I said, sure. So I started working upstairs with this guy named Jimmy Smith, and I started talking to him about plays. He'd make a call and I'd ask him about it because I was interested. And so I went and got a rule book, and I started reading the rule book, and we were talking. We had some, I could have more intelligent conversations with this guy because I actually had a rule book and knew what was going on and a little bit more. And before I left Johnson City, I worked there as an official scorer. Moved out of there, and I lived in a couple of other places for a while. There was no baseball anywhere close to where I was. We came to this area in 1988, and I lived in Woodbridge, 2 miles from the ballpark where the minor league team that's now known as the Potomac Nationals play. They've gone through a few names in the time I've been here. And after I was there a couple of years, I was going to games, and I met Jerry Gregory, grand old Sabre guy, who introduced me to the official scorer one night before a game and told Jerry that I had worked as an official scorer in the past. So the scorer and I talked, and I filled in for him for a few games that summer. 1992 was the first summer I worked over there. And then every year it got to be more and more and more games I was working. So, you know, I've passed 1,000 games in that ballpark now, which is, I went back and tried to figure out anybody in any capacity working over there in Woodbridge. No one's come close to that. About 800 is about the closest I found somebody that might have worked in the press box or even anything else in that ballpark. But so I've been working over there a long time. Been through a lot of parent clubs like the Yankees and White Sox, Cardinals, Reds, and the Nationals since 05 have been over there, which is a good situation for them. And been through a lot of managers, met a lot of people over there, scouts and managers and whatever. And you find some managers are better to work with than others. Some coaches I don't want to talk to. And, you know, it depends on their attitude. As long as a manager is an adult about the conversation and is intelligent and not just want to be upset with me, then I'll talk to him. We'll talk about a play and I'll consider his request. So there, I kind of just fell into that job. The guy eventually, after I was there a few years, the guy retired and I took over full time. So that a lot of it is being in the right place at the right time, but you have to have the knowledge too. So that's kind of fun. And then in the winter of 2004-05, when it was announced that the Expos were moving to Washington, the announcement was finally made. There had been rumors for a while. I wrote to the PR guy with the Expos, who I knew, and expressed a desire to be a scorer in D.C. And he asked me for a resume, a scorer's resume. So I sent him a one-page resume. And I was hired by... it's kind of tricky. In the big leagues, actually, any level, the league hires the scorers, and the scorers work for the league, whether it be the Carolina League over in Woodbridge or Major League Baseball in D.C. But they want local people to try to find candidates. And the final decision is made in the league office. So I got a call from the commissioner's office, from one of the vice presidents for Major League Baseball, saying that I was going to be hired and I was going to be the primary guy and that I was supposed to work opening day and any of the other sort of big nights, you know. And so opening night 2005, the home opener at RFK, Levon Hernandez threw the first pitch against the Diamondbacks, and the first announcement I'm supposed to make is the time of the first pitch. And so I made some announcement to the point of the first pitch in Washington, D.C. in however many years it had been at that point, 32 years or whatever it was, came at 7:07 or whatever the time was. And, you know, so that was pretty cool to be there for that and be the scorer for that first game at RFK. And I worked the last game at RFK. I worked the first game at Nats Park, which was another pretty exciting night with the Ryan Zimmerman walk-off homer. I got to work as the official scorer for both of Steven Strasburg's debuts with his first arm and his second arm. So, you know, and a lot of other interesting nights. The Jordan Zimmerman no-hitter was mine, and so the first no-no there with the Nationals. And but, it, you know, starting as an eight-year-old, learning how to keep score and working in high school, and I got away from it in college, and I got away from it for a while after we left Johnson City, because I wasn't in a place where there was anything. And I got here, and I got lucky enough to have a minor league team. I've been involved with them for a long while. I had a big league team dropped in my lap in 2005, so that's how I got that job.
And to be clear, you do not do every Nationals game.
Correct.
There are multiple scorers who, three of them, who handle each Nationals season, and there is some benefit to having multiple people doing it, isn't
right.
there?
Right, right. Major League Baseball does not want the same person working every night. Bad feelings can arise if there's a call a team doesn't agree with, and that can fester and grow. And so I like the idea, and I'll be this summer in 2016, I'll be working about 30 games in Washington, split with the other two guys. And you know, it's an interesting job, but I like to have a life too some days. And you know, and it's funny too, because when I'm not at the ballpark, I don't watch the games, because I see enough baseball during the summer that I'm not going to sit in front of the TV and watch the game. I might see parts of games on the TV, especially if my wife has the game on. It's kind of funny for her, because she doesn't go to the park very often, but she'll have the game on here if I'm working, and she'll know what's going on. Mm-hmm. And if I'm working the minor league stadium where there's no TV, she'll go monitor every once in a while on the website to see what's going on. And the other night, I was working, and we got well into the game before anybody scored a run, and she sent me a text in the middle of the game and said, somebody needs to score a run for you. So I'm not there half the night on an extra inning ball game or something, you know. But I have fun. I enjoy the job. I'm pretty good at the job, but I also want to get away from there once in a while.
You know, as you mentioned, separating yourself from the game when you're away from the stadium, is that because it's intellectually exhausting in some ways, that you have to be concentrating so hard when you're doing the game, or in some cases interpreting a very difficult situation on the spot?
I think some nights it's both. Some nights are easy, but I have to watch every pitch. and I can't be distracted. I can't be watching other things going on. When the pitcher starts his motion, I have to be aware of what's going on, because you never know what's going to happen. You know, I mean, especially if there's runners on base. You got a runner on first, and I have to keep track of that runner. When the pitcher starts his motion towards the plate, I need to know, did he start running or is he still standing there, just taking a bit of an extra lead to say, if the ball gets away from the catcher, if he advances, is it a stolen base or is it a wild pitch or something? And I have to know that by, did he start with the pitch? So, yes, and there's lots of situations like that. A ball hit in the right field corner and there's a runner rounding third, I need to be able to see if he kept running or stopped and started up again and watched the play in right field at the same time. And, you know, I got one eyeball going one way and one eyeball going the other way.
Is it too much for one person? Should there be two people doing this?
No, there's not. I've developed habits that I know things that I need to do at particular times, and I don't have to watch the ball the whole time down the right field line. I only have to watch it when the fielder's about to play it. Mm-hmm. So I can peek at the runner, and I can peek back at right field, and I can peek back at the runner, and I can see what's going on watching both places. The problems come in where at Nats Park, I can't see the left field corner. There's a piece of it that I can't see. And so if I think there might have been a misplay, I have to wait and see if I happen to get a glimpse of it on a replay on the television. But, you know.
Now, what happens if you legitimately just miss something? Can you go to the videotape? You go to the videotape?
In Washington, we have a big flat screen monitor next to us with a TiVo machine. And I can run it back and I can see the play. We get the feed straight from the truck. And even with coming straight from the truck, there's about a 4-second delay from when the play starts, you know, when something happens where it actually shows up on my screen for the first time. So I can see a pitch, and then I can turn left and look at the screen, and I can see the pitch again the first time it's on the TV. And then they might show a replay, so I can see it three times without any effort at all, usually. So, and I do look. Pitches in the dirt with base runners is a problem. If, you know, I need to be sure that it actually hit the ground or didn't hit the ground, or where was it when the catcher was trying to catch it to determine a wild pitch or a pass ball. And in the minor leagues, that's probably the hardest call, because I don't have TV, I'm blocked by the umpire and the catcher, I have to go strictly on what I hear. And, you know, if every once in a while coach may want to talk about that and say, you know, we'll talk about it, what they saw from the side, which they have a better view of that than I do, and I'll go with them most of the time if they say, no, that didn't hit the dirt. So, you know, but you know, I'm kind of stuck there because I don't have any TV.
90% of calls that's been written, most people can interpret.
Yeah.
And it's that hard 10% that you're really responsible for.
Yeah.
With the help of replay, are you pretty confident after the fact that you've gotten most of that difficult 10% correct?
Most of the time. Every once in a while there's a call that I can be talked out of, especially in the minor leagues where I don't have the replay. But it's not that often. And, you know, and like I said, if a coach wants to talk to me, and if he's going to be an adult about it, we have an intelligent conversation, I'll talk to him. If he's going to act like a big baby, then we're done, you know, and I don't even listen to him. I'll just say, and I don't go by myself. I will not talk to a manager in the minor leagues without a team representative there, the PR guy there with me to have a conversation. And, you know, it's coverage for me. You know, there's been some bad situations in the past, and I'm just not going to get myself into that again.
But it takes years of experience to get where you are.
Yes.
You were saying about how you have, you know, you're able to sort of let a ball down the line go for a little bit while you watch other parts of the field, but a younger scorer may not be able to do it, and it takes time.
Yes, it does.
I mean, how long reasonably do you have to have done this before you're ready to be a major league official scorer?
That's tough to say. You know, everybody grows at a different rate, and it doesn't matter if it's algebra or intellectually grows, you know, if it's whatever the topic is. And some people will never get there. Some people could work 15 years in the minors and still be bad and should not work in the big leagues. Mm-hmm. Not to say that they should be working in the minor leagues. I mean, I've seen some scoring in the minor leagues that I thought was horrendous too, but that's beside the point. And I mean, you have to know the rule book, the whole section on scoring, and a lot of other sections that are referred to in the scoring section. You have to know how to interpret all that. And you have to have a certain amount of experience to have seen some unusual stuff and know how to handle things and know how to handle yourself with people who are going to come and question you. So, you know, it's funny now in the minors, I don't really get any grief from anybody anymore. And I think to a certain extent, it's because these coaches find out before they ever talk to me that I'm a big league scorer. And so there's a whole different mindset on their side, I think. And I like it. You know, I don't want to get into any of these issues and arguments and people yelling and screaming and, you know, or coming after me physically, as one manager did one time, which we can get into later. But, but you know, at this point, at 12th year in with the Nationals, someone told me last summer in passing, said, you've probably worked more Nationals games than any other scorer. And I thought at the time, well, I hadn't thought about that, but yeah, you're right, probably. And now I have factual information to prove that I'm way ahead of whoever's in second place. But and that's kind of an interesting thing too, that, you know, I've been around enough and I've seen enough that most nights I'll have seen everything that happens on the field in the past. You know, every once in a while I see something and think, oh, I haven't seen that before. But, you know, and it's...
What is it then that keeps you attracted to being an official scorer after all this time?
I get to sit in one of the best seats in the ballpark. I get paid to sit in that chair. And to earn my money, I'm told, watch the ball game. And while I watch the ball game, I make decisions that affect history. Because if something's a hit or an error, that affects two players' stats, at least, probably more than that. And statistics are more and more driving the sport for contracts and for postseason awards and, you know, Hall of Fame voting and all kinds of other things that, you know, and all these fantasy players that are out there doing things. And it matters. And as much as I like to say one call's not going to change your season, that's not the way the players look at it. One call can make a big difference in their head. And that's unfortunate, because I think it's gone a little bit too far that direction. And, you know, luckily they can't talk to me. They can't call upstairs. They can't have me come downstairs. They can't do any of that anymore because there's other procedures in place now. But, you know, I kind of like the idea that I'm affecting, you know, that some of the things that I do has an effect on what's going on.
Now, in terms of the qualities necessary to be an effective official scorer, it isn't something where a fan of a team needs to do it. You need someone who's unbiased.
Right, right.
And as someone who has followed baseball for a long time, how can you maintain a certain unbiased approach in your scoring?
I mean, this may sound like I'm lying, but I'm not. I don't pay attention to who's at the plate, who's in the field. I don't watch uniforms. I don't read game notes. So I don't know that player X has a 15-game hitting streak going on, because that could influence me, and I don't want to know that stuff. The TV screen that I have next to me is muted. Every screen in the press box is muted by rule. I mean, I'm not allowed to listen to audio. It's in my letter of appointment every year, it says we're not allowed to listen to the audio of the broadcast, which I don't want to listen to it anyway. I don't need them telling me anything, you know. So, you know, if it's a Bryce Harper or if it's an Albert Pujols as a visiting player or whoever, you know, okay, fine, you know, or somebody that I may not even know what his name is when he comes to the plate, other than the names on my score sheet. And, you know, and it's not supposed to matter. It doesn't matter to me. And I didn't grow up in this area. I grew up in a different area. I root for a different team in the big leagues. And I have worked games with that team as a visitor. Mm-hmm. And it didn't matter. Mm-hmm. You know, I just make the call, you know. And afterwards, I may think about it later, but I don't think about it at the time.
And you had written an article in 2005 where you listed out qualities that were essential for any official scorer. And it's safe to say the first quality is a comprehensive knowledge of the rule book. You can't go looking everything up every time something happens.
Right.
And can you comment a little on your own knowledge of the rule book and how you developed it?
Well, I bought a rule book way back, and because I was kind of interested in it. I was geeky enough that I found that fascinating. And as I was reading it, and I was trying to work back and forth through one rule refers to another rule and all this sort of thing, and trying to find all the ins and outs of it. And at this point, after all these years, every spring, I still read the rule book every year before I start my season, because it's a refresher, and every year there's one rule I look at and I say, yeah, I would have forgotten about that, you know. And so you do need to know the rules, and in the minor leagues especially, I find a lot of opportunity, educational opportunities, where I can talk to the PR people or sometimes even the manager and explain a rule to them. The home manager that I've got this year, he's been there a couple of years now, and last summer he asked if he could talk to me the next afternoon, and he said, bring your rule book, I want to talk to you about a rule. And that, he didn't want to talk about one of my calls. He wanted to talk about one of the scoring rules that I used to make a call that night. He wanted to go through the whole thing, and it was an educational situation for him. Mm-hmm. And I love that stuff, you know, to help him understand better. So he becomes a better manager, and he can approach a scorer in a better way, you know. And, you know, that's really good. And, you know, so it's knowing the rules, but knowing how to interpret the rules as well. Those are the two key things.
I can say you have five rules that you listed, which one, the first was knowing the rules, then applying the rules, then having the integrity to make the call regardless of consequence.
Right.
And if someone is upset, to know that they are upset at the call and not at you personally.
Right, it's the uniform, not me.
And then the fifth rule was to be aware of the entire field during the play, which you mentioned
before. And that's the hard part sometimes, because it's a big field. And, you know, but you develop habits where you know. And the guy in Nationals Park, the guy who runs the balls and strikes on the scoreboard, he's been there since the very beginning in 05 at RFK, and we've become friendly over the years, and a lot of nights before games, we'll sit together and talk while we eat, and every time he'll introduce me to somebody new working there in that area. Nationals have a lot of people that run all these different, the audio and the video and all this stuff on the scoreboards and all this. And, you know, we'll be sitting at a table and there'll be six of us, and he'll introduce me to somebody that's new or relatively new. And every time he introduces me to somebody, he says, he told me something the very first week, the very first year, that I've carried with me ever since. You know, and it's the fact that I told him, because I noticed the first game there was a stolen base and the pitch didn't go on the scoreboard right, the ball or the strike. Because everybody's reaction is to watch the play at second base. And he completely missed the result of the pitch. And so I said, you watch until the umpire gives you some indication whether it's a ball or strike. Then you can look at second base. You still have plenty of time to get your eyes there before that play is over. Mm-hmm. And he uses that, and he tells everybody that. And I love it, because so there's already a second generation instruction going on, you know, with that one thing at least, you know. So if you learn how to do it, you learn where you have to concentrate and when you can go look at other things, that's not as hard as it seems.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you are up in the booth, you have a rule book with you.
Yes.
Is there anything else that you bring along that's helpful as an accessory?
I have my own score sheet that I put together for myself that has just what I want on it and nothing extra. And, you know, multiple pens and whatever, but that's really all I need. In the big leagues, I bring my computer with me. I have a scoring program that I use. A lot of the big league scorers don't use a computer. I like it because I track plays. I put plays in as they happen, and I'm supposed to announce pitching lines. When a pitcher comes out of a game, I'm supposed to announce the innings pitch and hits and runs allowed and walks and strikeouts and anything else beyond that. And by putting the plays in the computer, every play in the computer as it happens, this program on the screen shows me the pitching line as it runs. So I can just look at the computer and I can announce the pitching line. I don't have to go through my score sheet and count up five walks or whatever it is. You know, I can just look and I've got it. Because the computer does the counting for me. It's the 21st century. Why should I do it myself, right?
Now, give me a couple of misconceptions people might have about the role of the official scorer.
The first one, the biggest one, is that I work for the team, and I don't. I work for the league.
Partially, that's because you're referred to as the Washington Nationals official scorer.
Is not really correct. I'm the official scorer assigned to Nationals Park, mm-hmm. which is subtle, but it's different. Yes. You know, we are assigned to a ballpark or ballparks in some cases. In Chicago, most of those guys work both parks occasionally. But that's the biggest misconception. The second is that I might be talking to players or players might be talking to me. And I mean, I've never met most of the Nationals. A couple of those players I've met just by chance somewhere. Mm-hmm. But
you are down on the field occasionally.
Not very often. Sometimes. But without a uni number on, I wouldn't know some of those faces. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, obviously I would know Ryan Zimmerman if he walked up to me. I would know Harper if he walked up to me. I would know some of the pitchers if they walked up to me. But some of them, you know, he can introduce me. Well, and Jason Worth just from the hair. But, yeah. But you know, some of them walked up to me. I mean, they could walk, their brother could walk up and I wouldn't know the difference. Yeah, you know, in most cases, I think. And it's much more the case in the minor leagues because those guys come through and they're there maybe 1 year, maybe a year and a half, and they're gone. And it's not like the big leagues where Ryan Zimmerman made his debut in September of 05 and he's still there. You know, he's been there almost as long as I have. So, yeah, But the biggest misconception really is that I work for the team and I don't.
You mentioned before about how people, you know, can develop an intuition, perhaps, for how to become a good official scorer. What qualities does someone need if they want to get into being an official scorer, presumably first on the minor league level?
Beyond the rule book and all that sort of thing, attention to detail, the ability to concentrate and not be distracted, because if you go to a ballpark and you sit in the stands and you see all these people and most of them aren't paying attention to the game, you know, they're out there to party, have a good time, and the ball game is in some cases secondary. Well, that's not the case here. The ball game is it, and all the distractions that go on you have to put out of your mind. And I like to joke about the Peanuts cartoons where the adults are all the sounds of the adults talking, all that wah 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 stuff, and everything else except the game, that's all that is to me. Mm-hmm. is just that, like that trombone, that's the adults and the Peanuts. So, but
it's like you're alone, kind of.
Yes,
some strange way.
Yes, I need a cone of silence, you know. I need, you know, and I'm in the main press box with the writers in both ballparks, but there are some ballparks where the scorers are in a separate room with perhaps the PA guy or perhaps nobody. Or
it would,
you
know, seem that would be better.
In some ways that would be better. In some ways it's not. Because between innings, that's my break time. Yeah. And I get up a lot of innings and I can move around a little bit and I have some space to move. And I know most of the, especially the guys who sit down near where I am, I know them enough that we can talk about stuff and they'll ask me questions and I'll bring up something I see going on, and sometimes I see them scribbling notes to themselves to put it in their story, you know, but, you know, I wouldn't want to be in a room by myself because it's too stifling.
Yeah, now you're well known for your home run work.
Yeah.
Cataloging basically every home run that's ever been hit.
Right.
What is the overlap between your work in cataloging home runs and being an official scorer? What connects the two besides just baseball?
Well, the home run research is almost kind of secondary now because I've been spending much more time on umpire research and stuff related to that, ejections, replays, and some other stuff like that. And the four umpires on the field and the official scorer are the five representatives from Major League Baseball who are there to officiate the game. And as such, you know, I like to joke with the minor league guys and say it's us against the rest of the world out there. And they all laugh about that, but it's true, you know. And so I'm spending more time on this other research. And I still keeping up with the home run stuff. But, I mean, the connection really is that it's just baseball in terms of the home runs. But for the other stuff, it's more Well, you know, there was no umpire research going on. There was nobody doing any kind of database for umpires. And the stuff that I've been able to put together is out on the Retro Sheet website now, where not only do we have players and managers, but I've helped put together a big coaches collection database. And now the umpires are out there, and the umpires love it. Mm-hmm. They're thrilled that somebody's paying attention. They're thrilled that they can go look and see numbers related to their career, how many games they've worked in the big leagues, you know, and a list of their ejections out there on their page, you know. And it's fascinating to them that I would take that time. But I've developed a lot of friendships with the umpires because of that and some other things. And it's fun for me too, because I've made some friends there of people who hardly anybody really knows. I mean, an umpire is no more than it's like a black shirt out on the field, you know, mm-hmm. with a hat on. You don't know who it is, or a blue. Everybody calls them blue, but and it's the same for us. Anonymity is kind of nice.
Yeah, the job has a certain thanklessness to it.
Yeah,
you're not
every night.
That.
Every night I have the ability to make somebody mad.
But. Does the grief, whenever it occurs, if someone's particularly mad at a call that you make, does that roll off your back?
More so than it used to. And I think to a certain extent it's also partly I get less grief now than I used to.
By being more established, you mean,
right? Maybe. I'm better at the job than I was 20 years ago.
And you too. Have more safeguards. If you're doing this at 85, you don't have multiple replays.
Yeah. But, you know, it's... You know, I'm better at the job, and so less things might come up that somebody wants to comment on. And especially with the home manager in the minor leagues, the major leagues, I don't talk to them. The minor leagues, my league president, he wants all of us as scorers in the Carolina League, if a manager wants to talk to us, to listen to them, mm-hmm. as long as they're adult about it, and I'm fine with that. And so I make a point with the home manager every time the manager changes to go out and introduce myself, mm-hmm. just to say hello and say, if you need to talk, you talk to the PR guy, he has my phone number and we can talk, mm-hmm. whether it be on the phone or in person, doesn't matter. And you know, it's a little bit of upfront, let them see my face, doesn't hurt. You know, and it's been good the last few years. I'll probably, next time I'm down there at the minor league park, it'll probably all fall apart in the next series, but who knows? You know, it's been, other than the weather, it's been pretty good so far.
You know, often when there's a controversial play, like a play at second base involving new sliding rules or something
right,
like that,
right.
ESPN will pull out all sorts of examples of how it's been interpreted in the past.
Yeah.
To what degree do you rely on precedent? And do you say, I remember this play in a particular game, I better go look at that and see if it's the same as what I just saw.
No two plays are alike, exactly alike. And I mean, there's similarities. You can show similarities between plays, but I mean, there's always something to make a play different. And with that said, though, we are working at the major league level. The scores are working at consistency. We have meetings every winter. We've had people like Joe Torre and others at that level come in and talk to us, and we've been working at a consistency of interpretation of rules to avoid having a score in Minneapolis take a play and rule it completely different than a score in Washington. And, you know, we don't want that. We want to be able to have some consistency, and we want to be able to say, well, you know, this is what we were instructed to do. This is how this rule gets interpreted. I had a play 10 days ago in the minor leagues, a pop-up. There was nobody on base. A pop-up in front of it ended up in front of the plate, and it's not the catcher's ball. In fair territory, the first baseman, the third baseman, one of them is supposed to catch that ball. The poor catcher, he's standing behind the plate looking up, and he's backing up, because the ball tends to come towards the field as it comes down. And he kept backing up, and he didn't get out there far enough, and he kind of lunged, and the ball fell to the ground untouched, about 2 feet on the grass outside the dirt circle at home plate. So about 18 feet from home plate. The first baseman was just standing there. It was his ball. It was on that side. He should have called the catcher off, but he just stood there and watched. Third baseman didn't do anything either. So That's a mental error. It's not a physical error. The rule book says mental errors are not to be judged as an error. Thus, that ball that landed 18 feet from home plate, the batter reached second on the play, was a double. And everybody looked at me in the press box, funny. I can't do anything about it. We were told if you got two or three players there and they all back off, you know, and they're like, you're taking it, it's a hit. So I had an 18-foot double the other night in the minor leagues, which one of the weirdest things I've ever seen.
So. Are there particular rules that you still feel to this day are especially ambiguous and in need of reform?
Yeah, that's a good one, too. And we've been talking about that, and that's why we're putting together a manual to go in with the rule book just for us. And we're talking about some of the rules that are a little squishy, or the rules that aren't used very often, don't come up very often, and sort of solidifying them. So I would say at this point, there's a lot less of that. I mean, there are rules that I don't like. I don't, you know, I mean, that double that fell in should have been an error on somebody, but, you know, nothing I can do about it, we're getting more and more to the point that the big holes have been closed by us having meetings and taking care of it. And it's not just the scores. Elias Sports Bureau in New York is the official statistician of Major League Baseball. And if we ever have a question, we call Elias during the game, after the game, whatever. We can call, talk to somebody, Elias. They have some knowledgeable people there, and we can talk through a play. They'll watch the play and call me back, and we'll talk through it. And I had one of those last year that we talked after a game, and I changed the call that I made during a game based on the discussion I had with one of the lead guys at Elias. And you know, that's important backup for us, that we have somebody we can talk to. Because I'm not going to talk to anybody in the press box. You know, the writers might not have seen the play. You can't talk to a team guy, you know. So that's our lifeline, you know.
But your fidelity is to the text.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So you have to be a textualist in some sense. So.
Until it gets to the point that there's a giant hole in the rule, and there's a sentence in the scoring rules that says the official score... I forget the exact wording, but the effect is the official scorer has the authority to rule on anything not specifically covered in these rules.
Mm-hmm. So if you had said, you know, that's ridiculous to have an 18-foot double.
But it's covered. That's covered by what we've been instructed to do by the rule that says mental errors are not errors. Mm-hmm. Now, there's a couple of exceptions. We've all seen outfielders catch the third out and throw the ball in the stands. Mm-hmm. Well, if they do that with runners on base after two outs, runners get to advance automatically, and that is an error. That's specifically noted in the rule book that, although that starts out as a mental error, that is a physical error, and to judge it as an error on that player. So
you do have to divine intent a little bit.
Yes.
Similar to
yes.
what you mentioned with the first baseman, where you said, you know, that guy should have had it.
Yes.
And that's quite subjective and could vary.
Yep. Yep,
and
you know, I think that's part of the problem with the ball that falls in behind second base, where the center fielder and the shortstop and the second baseman all watch each other instead of the ball. Part of the problem is, whose ball was that?
Yeah,
you know, and in some cases, it's almost like just pick a player if you want. But I mean, that 18-foot double was obviously the first baseman, just because of where it landed. It wasn't center; it was off to the right, and you know, but. My hands were tied.
But what I'm hearing you say is you're not concerned with what the intent of the rule was.
Well,
what the rule says literally.
No, I think both. Okay. I think both. You know, I mean, you have the text, but there is a certain amount of interpretation sometimes. Some rules are real straightforward. Mm-hmm. You know, a batted ball that falls in the outfield untouched is a hit. There's no question about that. You know. But there's some other rules that, you know, based on experience, you make a decision based on what you saw in the play. So,
do you feel that interpretations are changing with time? In other words, would it have been, you know, you talk about, let's say, reasonable effort to go and get
right,
a ball or
right.
something like that. Is it something where it might have required more effort in a particular period than in another period for an error? Or if they kept it consistent, relatively
speaking. Since I've been working, I wouldn't say things like that have changed. Rules have changed. Mm-hmm. And in some cases, a few years ago, the unearned run rule had what turned out to be, was determined to be a typographical error in it. It said not when it shouldn't have said not in one particular part of it. And based on a catcher's, reaching base on a catcher's interference. And that whole rule, that part of that rule completely did a 180 in the middle of a season a few years ago. We were instructed that this is the way the rule is supposed to be. This is the way we're going to do it. And you know, so that was a huge change for me. Mm-hmm. And, it, you know, although that doesn't come up that often, but it was just something I had to, you know, plug into the old computer upstairs and say, if that comes up, you got to remember that. But I think the way I've interpreted some things has changed slightly because of the work we're doing as, you know, as a group. Nobody is going to find themselves the same as what we end up with all the time. Everybody's going to have one thing that we've talked about, an interpretation that they're going to have to sort of toe the line. Mm-hmm. You know, and there's been some where I've made some slight adjustments based on how, what we've talked about based on to how I interpret a rule. But that's good though.
What are the hard ones? I imagine whether something's an earned run or not, I know you've written about.
Most people have the most trouble with the earned run business. And that can be difficult. Most of it's not that hard. It's when you have multiple pitching changes and multiple errors, and you know, you have to start assigning the runs to the right pitchers, and then now which ones get to be unearned and which ones are earned, and then there's also the team unearned where the pitcher is dinged for the run but the team's not, and so there's three categories there.
I would say you're going through an inning and play it as if the error didn't happen,
right?
But the issue is going to be in terms of taking extra bases and things like that,
right?
And
right.
But other than that, it should be pretty straightforward.
Well, you give the pitcher the benefit of the doubt according to the rule. Okay. So you know, there's that part of it, and there's okay, so the first baseman fumbled that grounder and the batter reached. Well, he's out. So, you know, there's an out. And if there was a runner on first, well, we know he would have gone to second anyway. You know, so you do have to go through with that. And sometimes I find myself doing that during the inning. What do I have now? Because there's already been an error. Where am I right now in my head? Where are these runners and how many outs are there? So I'm sort of starting to do that even before the inning's over. Mm-hmm. And that can be helpful. So at the end of the inning, I can say, you know, two runs, no earned runs. Mm-hmm. And I'm ready to go, and I don't have to take a minute to do it. Mm-hmm. So, but earned runs can be tricky.
Do you ever wish you had someone sitting next to you and you could bounce an interpretation off of them? Or do you feel better being solo?
I have 24 hours to make a change. Mm-hmm. And so I will do my best to make the judgment at the moment, and if I'm still not totally comfortable with it the next morning, I'll go back and go through it again. Mm-hmm. And if I'm still not comfortable with it, I'll call Elias and say, would you look at this inning, tell me what you come up with, see if it's different than what I did last night. Mm-hmm. And you know, they're fine with that. That's part of their job. So I do have somebody I can rely on. It doesn't have to be at the moment. Mm-hmm. Because I do have the 24 hours from the end of the game to change a decision. Mm-hmm. So that's good too.
You mentioned all of the important games you've gone to, the Strasburg's first game or Zimmerman one. But to some degree, you can't get caught up in any of that stuff, no matter what's going on. So it's kind of nice to think about after the fact, but you can't say, wow, right, we're in the middle of a perfect game at the moment or something.
I walked in on the Strasburg debut night thinking this is huge, and the press box was overflowing. They had so many, writers. I mean, ESPN had about six people there, and you know, it was on MLB Network, and you know, Sports Illustrated had people there, and newspapers from all over the country sent somebody in. You know, it was like it was the All-Star Game or the World Series or something that night in terms of the media coverage. It was ridiculous how many people were there, and I have two seats assigned to me, so that I have plenty of space. And that night, I had somebody sitting in one of my seats. Happened to be Jason Stark from ESPN, and I specifically told the people that I knew were going to be figuring out seating, would you put the ESPN guys next to me? And they said, yeah, if that's what you want. I said, I'd rather that than almost anybody else. And so Jason's with me, and I don't remember who else. Tim Kirkshen was there, and some other those guys were there. But and they're all really busy, and I knew they'd be busy and wouldn't be bothering me. You know, that's why I wanted them there. So, but plus I'm friends with those guys. So, but there is pressure on a night like that. There is pressure in a no-hitter. But I don't worry about a no-hitter until you've been through the lineup at least twice. You know, I don't worry about it in the fourth inning, fifth inning, sixth inning. Get me to the seventh or eighth inning, and you know, then maybe I'll be thinking about it. The Jordan Zimmerman one, I didn't think he was going to throw a no-hitter, so I wasn't worried about it at all. and we got to the ninth inning, and I thought, whoa, wait a minute here. We still got this game going on, you know. And Christian Yelich, the Marlins outfielder, hit that ball with two outs in the ninth, hit that line drive to left center, and I thought, there you go, it's all over now. And Steven Souza made the Superman catch, and I just sat
you
there
for a second. Pay some attention to who's who.
Yeah, well, after the fact, I went back and looked. You know, I knew it was Souza at the time because people were talking about it, but I went back to find out who was the batter, and it was Yelich, and lefty hitter. And you know, at the time, I wouldn't have been able to tell you who it was batting. And the funny thing is that Souza had been put in the game late in the game as a defensive replacement. And then he goes and makes that catch. Ryan Zimmerman, had been playing left field. Uh-huh. And he would have made that catch.
Yeah, sure wouldn't.
That's Worth would have made players. That catch. You know, I think Worth was out or something, injured, I don't know what it was. But anybody else they might have had out there's no chance. And Souza only made the catch because he wasn't going to let that ball fall, you know. And you know, then he got traded the next winter. Yeah. Thank you very much. Go away. You know.
How hard is it to interpret the infield fly rule?
It's easy. Not my decision. Okay. That's the umpire's decision. They put their hand up, say infield fly, the batter's out. You know, and at that point, it becomes easy for me, and I just have to see if anybody tries to advance. If the ball falls in, uncaught. Then it starts to be a little bit of a headache for me because then people are probably going to run. Mm-hmm. But on the normal infield fly,
yeah,
easy.
Because no one ever advances anyway.
Right,
but it's
right. And that's not my decision to make. Well, that's another thing. In the scoring rules, it says the scorer can't make any decisions that are in conflict with an umpire's decision. Mm-hmm. Last night, game yesterday, there was a timing play, which is a third out was made on the bases on a tag play, and a runner was scoring at the same time, and the decision was by the home plate umpire that the run scored just before the third out was made, so the run counts. Mm-hmm. And it was actually challenged, and they used replay and upheld the call, but that's one of those things where I can't say, no, that I'm not putting that run down. The umpire said, run counts. Mm-hmm. You know, not up to me. Mm-hmm. So. And you know, that's I would joke. I know that home plate umpire in that game I know pretty well. And next time I see him, I'm going to joke with him a little bit about it. But
yeah. I wanted to transition into some of the specific things that you've observed over your time. And you had mentioned about people getting upset after a particular call. What's the most upset anyone has ever been with a call that you have made, and what happened?
In the minor leagues, I had. In June of 2001, there was a night where the visiting team wasn't a very good team. There was an umpire's call that was changed during the game on the field that went against the visiting team. They blew a big lead and lost the game, and there was some ground ball in the infield, and I don't know if I called it a hit or an error. I don't care. It doesn't matter. You know, it wasn't that big a deal. I called it whatever I thought it was. After the game, the phone in the press box rings, and it's a couple of seats down for me, and somebody picked it up and listened for a second and reached out and said, it's for you. I said hello, and what I heard on the phone wasn't, hi, this is so-and-so. What I heard was, and the exact quote is, you have to change that fucking call. And I stopped for a second, and I said, excuse me, who is this? And I knew perfectly well who it was. It was the visiting manager. And he just went off. He just kept going off. And after about five sentences, I said, I'm sorry, but I don't have to listen to this with you. And I handed the phone back. And the guy hung the phone up. And just after the phone's hung up, I see the manager come running up through the stands, still in uniform. There's still people out there exiting. And he's running up through the stands to the press box. And he's coming after me because I hung up on him. And we got the press box doors closed so he couldn't get in. And we started closing windows. And he was outside the door pounding and kicking on the door, yelling and screaming and swearing it, you know. And he came around the front. He's pounding on the windows. And I know that if that door was open, he would have come in and he probably would have decked me. Because he was really upset that I hung up on him. Because he thought I screwed his team, you know. Not that anything else went wrong, but he was going to take it out on me, you know. And, I mean, that's the worst I've ever seen. It took them a while. The coaches finally sort of sauntered up and took him away. And it turned out that the minor league director for that team was there in the ballpark that night. And so, but I had to call the league president and turn him in. I mean, there's no way if something like that happens, I have to turn that in. And I don't know what happened. I don't know if he was suspended, fined, don't care, mm-hmm. right? It just, the league president backed me up, and the next time that team was in town, the president was in the ballpark. And that meant a lot to me. John Hopkins he's always been very good to me in the Carolina League. We have a really good working relationship. And I told him the next year, we sat down and he brought that whole situation up. And he said, I want you to know that I don't hold you responsible at all for any of that. And I said, well, I appreciate that. And I looked at him and laughed and I said, I don't either, you know. But I told him, and I said, you came and it did mean a lot to me. And the league presidents are supposed to back up the scores in those sort of situations. I mean, I've had players in the press box and they're not allowed in the press box during the game. You know, all kind, and this is all the minors. You know, these weird things mostly happen in the minors. In the big leagues, there are some PR guys who get uppity about stuff. But now with the new appeal process, they mostly just keep quiet and stay away from us, which is fine with me. But, you know, I mean, having a manager come after me physically, that's just way out of line. I mean, there's no reason for that, you know. But for strange things, and again, a lot of this is in the minors, but I've seen some strange things at Nats Park. But, I mean, I've had games halted because the lights went out. Obviously rain, but we've had fog outs. I've had sprinklers come on in games. I've seen lightning delays. One night, some years ago, a player got hit with a fastball, batter got hit the fastball in the head, and he went down and was unconscious. And they eventually, after quite a delay, they carted him out, put him on a helicopter, and took him to the trauma center. Well, the helicopter's outside the ballpark on the right field, on the third base side. That's where it landed. And, you know, we sat there for a long while they took care of him, which is the right thing to do. So as soon as they get him off the field and the gates closed, the plate umpire said, all right, let's go. Throw a couple of pitches and let's get started. Lefty batter steps in the batter's box. First pitch, foul ball, off to third base side. I see a fireman running in on the field with his hands up waving. And we stopped the game again because that foul ball almost hit the helicopter before it took off. So we had a helicopter delay that night. They had to take off and get out of the area, and then we resumed the game again. And that's probably the weirdest delay I've ever seen. But, you know, five-man infields and all these shifts going on now, you know, that makes my job harder. Mm-hmm. Because I have to know when they start moving around one way or the other, and I'm starting to see it a lot with right-handed batters too, okay, which player is which player? First baseman is easy with the glove. And sometimes in the minors, I just have to know which guy has his socks up and which guy doesn't. Because I can't see numbers. So I have to pay attention and see them move. And I'll generally know which batters they're going to probably move on, and I'll watch them move. You know? But that does make life harder.
Has there been an error call that's been particularly difficult? Because, you know, whether someone's bobbling something in the outfield, that's very much open to interpretation. And I imagine that errors are among the more contentious things that you ever have to
hit and error are the things that most people are upset about.
To support your conclusion, yeah, but right, you may be challenged
right.
about it.
And of course, everybody wants every call to go their way, right? A hitter always wants everything to be a hit. A pitching coach wants everything to be an error for his pitcher. So, there's been times I had a coach come after me one night arguing, and but every other night he wanted to argue a call, and he went off about how this one call could be the big difference between this guy making it to the big leagues and not making it to the big leagues. And I told him, you know what, that's not my job, that's your job. So why don't you go do your job, let me do my job, and stop bugging me. And I walked away. And I never heard from him again, which was good. But they get wrapped up in it, and because it's their livelihood, and they think I'm messing with their livelihood, and I'm not. I'm just trying to go right down the middle and make a call based on what I see, based on my experience of looking at things. And, you know, I don't know. I suppose if I was a player, I might think the same way, especially if I'm 21 years old and trying to make it to the big leagues, you know. But the big leaguers, too. There's a lot of that going on with that, where they're turning calls in, and I'm thinking, really? You're going to turn that one in after all these other things that went on?
But tell me about the incident a few years ago when you appeared on television unexpectedly.
Yeah, that was at RFK. That was probably 2006. The Mets TV guys were upset with a call, apparently, and they were going off about things, and I don't know if they mentioned me by name or what they did, but the director decided to tell one of his camera guys to find me and put my face on the TV. So I was on the Mets broadcast that night during the game while they were saying what a horrible official score I was, or whatever they said. I didn't ever listen to it, and I got two emails from two friends up in the New York area that night who were watching the game and were quite surprised to see my face on the screen that night. So I went to the Nationals PR guy the next afternoon and told him, and he went to the Mets guy, and the Mets guy's a pretty nice guy, and he came to me before the game in the press box, stuck out his hand and said, on behalf of the New York Mets, I apologize for what happened. And I said, you know, I understand that you have no control over what they do. I appreciate the sentiment, but I understand. Just, it's not right. He says, no, it's not right. So, but, you know, at least it wasn't the home TV. Then all my friends would see it.
What is the most unexpected thing that has ever happened to you?
Wow. In terms of a play, there's a few. Back in 07, there was a ground ball. The Nationals were on the field, and there was a ground ball to third base. Ryan Zimmerman's there ready to field the ball, and I'm watching the ball go towards him, waiting for the play, and all of a sudden the ball disappeared. And in that brief instant right after, I no longer saw the baseball, I saw the left side of his jersey bulge out. So the ball came up, went in his shirt, and got caught in there. And my brain is processing this as it's going on. And I look down, I see the plate umpire come out from behind home plate, and he held up his hands and called time. He put Zimmerman on first, and I guess there might have been runners on, I don't know, but every runner was given a base, anybody that might have been on base. And so at that point, there's nothing in the rules to cover that for me. There is for the umpires. The ball gets lodged in a player's uniform. It's a dead ball. But there's nothing that says anything. So I went back to that. I get to rule on this, and that's a hit. I mean, it can't be an error on Zimmerman. His error was he'd never shirt closed properly. But, you know, that's not an error. So that was one of the strangest things. And at the end of the season, a guy that I happen to know was writing an article for Baseball Digest about a series of scoring decisions that stuck out in his mind during the season. And that was one of the ones that he wrote about, was that particular play. So, and somebody, one of the editors from Baseball Digest wrote to me and said, you know about this article? And I said, no. So they sent me a copy of the issue, and I still got that. It was one of those funny plays more than anything else, you know. And in 09, we were in Nats Park by then, and the Astros were in town. At that time, they were still National League, and their only trip into town, it was the last game of the series. And we were in extra innings, the bottom of the 11th inning, and we went into a rain delay for well over an hour, and they just kept sitting there because it was the last time that they were going to play in Nationals Park that season. And eventually they knew that they weren't going to be able to play. And so the game got suspended. And it was resumed, the game was in May, and it was resumed in July when the Nationals went to Houston. So it was the bottom of the 11th. The Nationals wore whatever unis they wore. They probably wore their road uniforms because they were on the road. But and they finished the game. I think there were like two batters to finish the game down there. Joel Hanrahan had been pitching for the Nationals when we were suspended. At the end of June, he was traded to the Pirates. But he was still the pitcher of record. The Nationals scored a run in the bottom of the 11th on a throwing error. Hanrahan got the win, although he was in Philadelphia and not in Houston, because he was in Philadelphia that night with the Pirates. And he got the win for the game that he had pitched a little bit in May. I was still the scorer of record, but Major League Baseball wasn't going to put me on an airplane and send me to Houston. So I sat in my living room with my computer and my score sheet and everything else and watched the end of the game. One of the Houston scorers was sitting in the chair in Houston, and we talked on the phone, and I scanned my sheets and everything and sent them to him, so he had all that. And we talked just before the game was going to restart. He timed that segment of the game. He knew the running time at that point. He timed the running, the last, whatever it was, 7 minutes, and added it together and announced the time of game. And we agreed on, you know, I mean, it was obvious who the winning and the losing pitchers were and all that, so most of it was easy. But we have to do post-game paperwork and turn it in. So I sat here at home that night and did the post-game paperwork and sent it in to New York. And he, you know, it took 10 or 15 minutes out of his life, which he didn't get paid for, but he was going to be working the other game that night, so sometimes that sort of thing happens. But that was a very strange situation because I watched the end of the game on television and I wasn't actually at the game when it ended, you know. So, things like that happen.
Can you do as good a job as an official scorer watching it on television? You're shaking
no.
your head no.
No, because your eyeballs on the play are always better. You can see the whole field. You can look at what you need to look at, not what the TV is forcing you to look at.
Mm-hmm. And you can also get certain variables, whether it's wind or
things
that might affect the player.
And he made the Houston guy. There was the last play was a throwing error, and he made the call on the error. That wasn't my call. He made, you know, we agreed that he was going to have to make whatever calls were necessary. And you know, but it was an obvious call. It wasn't a problem. It wasn't like I was going to call that a hit or anything. So we had no issues with that. That might have been interesting if it was a 50-50 call and we would have had to talk about it, you know, but but we didn't have that issue. So, but no, watching it on television, there's no way you could do the job.
In an article that you had written on scoring a few years ago, you had put a few scenarios out of potential plays, and I wanted to ask you about a couple of them.
Okay.
Because it involves a certain amount of interpretation. If the batter hits the ball down the right field line and runs to second base and then takes a few steps past the bag, and the right fielder throws the ball to the shortstop who's at the bag, then the shortstop tags out the batter slash runner before he can return safely to the base. What's your call?
Okay, he ran past the bag, not slid past the bag. When you run past the bag, you are considered to have attained that base, second base in this case. So by rounding the base too far and not getting back, that's a double, and then he's thrown out in that scenario 9-6. Now, if he let's change it up slightly. On a stolen base, guy tries to steal second, he gets in ahead of the tag, touches the base, he goes right by the bag, and then gets tagged out past the bag. Mm-hmm. When you slide past the bag, you never had the bag.
Okay.
Which is different than running by. So that's a caught stealing.
Ah.
So if he had slid past, the batter had slid past second and was tagged out, it would have been a single. Running past second, it's a double. And that's one of those rules that you have to know. It doesn't come up that often, but it's in the scoring rules, and it's one of those rules you have to know, and you can't go and make the wrong call or have to go look at the rule book for 5 minutes.
Suppose it's the last game of the season, and the home team needs to win to catch a playoff spot. The score is tied in the bottom of the ninth, and with a runner on second base, the batter hits a ball over the right field fence, and the runner from second scores. The batter rounds first and is mobbed by his teammates. They celebrate and eventually leave the field without allowing the batter to complete the circuit of bases. What's your call?
This has happened in the big leagues in postseason. It happened to the Mets in 2000 in either the World Series or the LCS. And it would have been a grand slam. He got to first base. He didn't get to second base. Even though he hit the ball out of the ballpark, that's a single and an RBI. Mm-hmm. Because you have to actually run the bases for it to count.
And with a runner on third base and nobody out, the catcher calls for an intentional walk for the batter. The second intentional ball sails very wide and high past the catcher, and the runner on third scores. Now the catcher resumes his usual position by the plate, and the upset pitcher throws two balls unintentionally out of the strike zone. What's your call?
It's not an intentional walk. The last ball is the only one that matters. Mm-hmm. You can throw three. I mean, you could start out not throwing intentional balls and throw three of them like that, and the last one being intentional makes it an intentional walk. If it's not, in this scenario, it's not an intentional walk. It's just a regular walk.
Mm-hmm. Last one. With the bases loaded and the batter is awarded first on catcher's interference and a run scores, what's your call?
Wait, say that again.
The bases are loaded.
Right.
The batter is awarded first on catcher's interference.
Right.
And a run scores. What's your call?
Well, catcher's interference is no time at bat for the batter and an E2. This is a tricky one, and this is one of those things that this is a rule that's actually the interpretation has changed recently. Bases loaded less than, well, it doesn't matter how many outs there are. The batter's going to get an RBI on that, and the run will be earned depending on what happens after that. Mm-hmm. It depends on the totality of the inning, but at that particular moment, that run is earned. Mm-hmm. But it's not a time at bat, and it's an E2.
Okay. And so what has changed?
Well, the change is, it used to be that a run scored by a batter who gets on by a catcher's interference was automatically unearned, and that's not the case anymore. It's now it's now an earned run because we don't know how his plate appearance would have ended.
Okay.
So, and I had to struggle with that one. I didn't like that change when they made that change, and I had to struggle with it, but there it is. So, I mean, I have to toe the official party line, you know.
You mentioned a lot of the sort of the odd things that have happened.
Yeah.
What has been the hardest inning for you to score that you've ever had to?
Well, you know, if there's, you know, 2-3 pitching changes and multiple errors and lots of runs, that gets a little tricky in terms of the earned run stuff. I had a play once way back in the minors. Was trying to think now. It's first and third. Runner from first took off with the pitch on an attempted steal. The throw goes through. Runner on third takes off on the throw towards second base. Takes off from the plate. Shortstop cut in front of the bag. Throws home. Catcher catches the ball. The runner slides in. The ball flies out of the catcher's glove. Mm-hmm. Runner's safe. The ball flies away a little bit. Catcher goes running after it. The runner who started it first on the throw home kept running to third base. He sees the ball's gotten away. He runs third, comes home. The catcher tracks the ball down, throws it to home plate where the pitcher is standing with his glove up, and the ball goes right by the pitcher because he's an idiot or something. I don't know. He doesn't catch the ball. Luckily for him, the third baseman was right behind him, caught the ball, tagged the runner out. So now we have a guy from first who comes all the way around and doesn't score. But he's not caught stealing because he tried to advance on the ball that got away from the catcher. But you have the guy from third base who tried to steal. He's safe only because the catcher lost the ball. He was tagged out. The ball went flying. Umpire says safe. That runner who scored was caught stealing. Mm-hmm. So the caught stealing was the runner who scored. The no caught stealing was the runner who was out. That's really backwards.
And luckily, you have 24 hours to get
there. Yeah. Well, it took me a while, but I finally got through all of that, you know. But you were talking about weird situations. I had a night one night years ago in the minors that before the game, they wouldn't give me a starting lineup. And I kept saying, I need a lineup. It's 5 minutes before game. What's going on here? So 5 minutes before game time, a trade was announced that involved the two teams, the big league teams, that were there representing in the minors. And one of the players on the visiting team was part of the trade. And he went from the visiting dugout to the home dugout and played the game. He showed up on the bus with his teammates from the hotel, took batting practice with his visiting teammates, went over the other side, put on a uniform, and led off for the home team that night. You know, it's one of those silly situations that you can only run into in the minor leagues, or in Bull Durham, probably. I don't know, maybe. So, but you know, it there's another rule too, the detached equipment rule. About 3-4 years ago, I had a play where there was a ball in the dirt. The catcher didn't catch it. He stood up, and as he stood up, he took his mask off with his right hand, and he's looking around for the ball. And the dugout's yelling at him. It was a runner on third. Dugout's yelling at him. The ball's right between his feet. So he took a step back. He leaned over, and he scooped the ball up with his mask, which is against the rules. It's called the detached equipment rule. And every runner on a pitched ball with detached equipment, every runner is allowed one base. Well, as soon as he picked it up, out loud I said to myself, you can't do that. And I see the plate umpire standing there, and he kind of cocked his head and probably thinking the same thing. You can't do that. And he stopped the play. He pointed at the runner on third and pointed towards home and said, you score. You know. And so I've never seen a detached equipment play in all the years. So I finally had one of those. I could check off, you know. Yeah, I've had one of those, you know. But I want to get back to something. You asked about tough things. Obstruction calls. The infield shifts are tough. Unearned runs are tough. Obstruction is also can be a tough play for a scorer. I had a play in the big leagues. A runner on second, ball hit to the outfield. Runner on second takes off. He's coming towards third. He's going around third, and third baseman got in his way and slowed him up. He kept running, and he was eventually tagged out at the plate. But the third base umpire saw the collision, and that's obstruction because the fielder's supposed to get out of the way of the runner. So instead of being out at the plate, he was safe because of the obstruction. Obstruction is, by definition, an error on the player who obstructed the runner. So that would have been an E5, except, and it says this in the rules, except if in the scorer's opinion, the obstruction didn't affect the play. Without the obstruction, the way I ruled it was, without the obstruction, he's running third and scoring plenty of time. Because he was only out by like two steps, and he would have scored without that obstruction. So I didn't charge the error. It was a hit and an RBI for the batter in that case. And so that's an interpretation based on what I can see. If I thought he was going to be out anyway, then the error would have counted and it would have been an RBI. But that can be tough because you don't see obstruction that often.
Yeah.
And there's a great deal of interpretation that has to be made there.
And it's a great deal of desire on the part of television commentators for you to get a call out as fast as you possibly can when taking a little bit of time and thinking, hey, is this obstruction would be nice.
Yes. They're in a big hurry, and you can see that if you watch any games now and you see these umpire replays and the commentators are acting foolish and saying things about stop listening to the elevator music and make the decision already, or maybe the guy in New York's in the bathroom, and all these ridiculous comments that I hear them make.
And you know, another one is sometimes they'll say that, well, that would have been scored a hit of on the road or something, scored an error at home and that kind of thing, which I can't imagine would ever be a...
In the big leagues, if that's happening in the big leagues now, then that person needs to be fired because... You know, if you're giving something to one of your players, the rule book is clear in terms of runs and earned runs to give the benefit of the doubt to the pitcher in terms of bases advanced without errors. If on a batted ball, if it's not played cleanly, the rule says give the benefit to the batter on the play. So, you know, if it comes down to the fact that you really can't make a decision, which I find hard to believe, but if you really can't make a decision, you're supposed to flop one way or the other based on that give the benefit of the doubt. But there's always got to be things you can look at and you can hang on to and say, this and this and this, it's a hit or an error or whatever.
It seems like fidelity to the rule book is the domain of the official scorer and not many others.
Yes.
You know, you always hear things like tie goes to the runner or something, all these things.
Which is not in the rule book.
Which is not in the rule book. And these things sort of become the...
Yeah.
The colloquial way of doing it.
Yeah, and I think that tie goes to the runner business is a little league thing. I mean, kids playing out on the sand lot or on the street or something. I remember hearing that growing up, but it's not true. The runner has to beat the ball to the bag to be safe. Has to beat the ball there. If you don't get there ahead of the ball because it's a tie, you're out. You have to get there first. So there is no tie. You're either out or you're safe. You know. But that's almost always retired players sitting in the television booth that say that.
Yeah, that's
you know? And then the other guy sitting there probably rolling his eyes, saying, you know, worried about it. So one other thing, we were talking about Nationals Park and games that I've worked. I've had the pleasure of seeing a lot of well-known people throw out ceremonial pitches, including two different United States presidents. And I joke about, I've seen a righty and a lefty throw out ceremonial pitches as presidents. And I'm not talking politics, I'm talking throwing hand. But, I'll say that to people and I'll say, well, of course, the throwing hand, at least in a certain amount, matches the politics of the individual president in each case, you know. So we're going to have an election soon, and next year, maybe I'll see another president throw out a ceremonial pitch. That would be fun. I remember that in 05, opening day, first Nationals game, George Bush came out. The next game, the second night, the vice president was there, Cheney. And I started thinking, well, we're going to have Secretary of State the third night. We're going to go right down the order of succession or something, you know. And it didn't work that way. We get a lot of generals and admirals. I'm a lot of military, and it's not usually some sergeant or ensign or somebody. It's usually big deals, you know. And that's kind of interesting to see. And it's fun to see all the military in the park and how well they're treated in the park. And they do a really tough job, much tougher than I'm doing. You know, lives don't depend on what I'm doing. But and it's the same with the police and the fire department and all of them. They have those guys out all the time, even just color guards and things, and I love seeing that go on. So that's a benefit to being there, you know, and in addition to being able to watch the game.
I'll go back a little too. You mentioned before about, you know, to a degree you're recording history.
Yes.
I mean, not to a degree, you are recording history. I mean,
to 100% degree.
And I mean, that is a weighty responsibility.
Yes.
In a way.
And I don't take it lightly, and I really don't joke about it on the job. I don't, you know, I don't joke about things, about calls or any of that. I'm very serious about that. Mm-hmm. But it is. It is a responsibility that we all do take seriously.
We know people in Sabre who go back and, you know, try and get RBI records from 100 years ago precise.
Right.
Or, you know, we saw Ty Cobb's batting average change after however many years and so forth. And it can be hard for people who aren't in the baseball community to understand how important it is to have that just so.
Right.
Because it isn't just what happened last night. It is in perpetuity.
Right. And, you know, and if somebody does have a hitting streak going on and they're 0-for-3 and their last time up they hit a ground ball that's fumbled, you know, that's an important call there, but it's also an important call if it's the first guy in the game, you know, and regardless of what his batting average is, it's the same call, and it shouldn't matter if the guys get a hitting streak or not, but after the fact, it does matter.
Yes,
you know,
but not to you.
Not to me at the moment I'm making the call. Maybe a week after that, somebody might say something to me about it, and, you know, oh yeah, or the no-hitter or whatever, you know. And
but to do it the other way would be to invite bias. If you were to give someone a hit call because they extended his hitting streak, that would be
the last,
out of bounds in every respect.
I want to be able to walk away from this job and have people not have anybody say he was a homer. That he made calls based on the uniform. And nobody can do that. And 10, 15 years ago in the minor leagues, I'd hear home managers or coaches say to me, we're getting screwed on the road by scores, and now we're getting screwed at home. And, you know, and my response to that, the first time I heard it was, Okay, wait, let me make sure I know what you're saying. You had a call on the road that you think was made based on uniform and went against you. So you're saying that guy didn't do his job correctly. And so you want me to make up for him by not doing my job correctly and give you a call. Oh, no, I'm not saying that at all. Okay, then we're done here. Bye. You know, and that was part of becoming a better scorer was, for me, was I hear certain lines all the time from people. And I need an answer to shut them up. If it's a line that has no basis being in the discussion, I'll hear pitching coaches say, well, that caused an unearned run, and no, it's a hit or an error. I don't want to talk about runs. We're talking about a ground ball that was a hit or an error. Whether it turned into a run later is immaterial to whether that was playable or not. And so they shut up at that point, because that's their whole argument, is that was a run that I want to be unearned. Well, sorry, that's not why we're talking. And then when we get done with it, I'll say, take that lesson away with you and remember it. Don't talk to a scorer about runs. Talk about, he should have made that play. Okay, thanks. Yeah.
Give me some broad lessons you've taken away from your own career, the things that you know now that you didn't know when you started.
Well, one of them is, if somebody's upset, they're upset at the call, they're upset at the uniform, so to speak, they're not upset with me. I'm just the person in the way at that particular moment, you know, and I have to not take it personally. I am serious enough about the job that I take every call seriously, and I want to get it right. I believe I get calls right, and if someone objects, if someone is upset, it still does to a certain extent upset me, but nowhere near the extent that it used to. Mm-hmm. You know, I've got other things going on in my life that I don't need to worry about that particular call on that particular night, last June or whenever it was, you know. And, you know, I'll walk out of the park every night and be confident that I did my job right, because if there's a call that I don't think I got right, I'll fix it before I leave the ballpark. You know, I'm not walking out of there and leaving
the
something
The goal
hanging.
Is to be correct.
Right, so. Right. And correct to based on the rules and the interpretation of the rules, mm-hmm. You know. And so that's the big thing. And I think that's the number one lesson I would tell anybody wanting to do this job is try to divorce yourself from the emotion of someone yelling at you. And we're all human, and it's not easy. Mm-hmm. But it's the same thing the umpires go through, except they go through it a whole lot more than I do.
Yeah.
You know, strike zone every night. Whatever. So, but that's one. If anybody wanted one lesson, that's the lesson. And that's maybe the second lesson is, don't get distracted. Make sure you're paying attention. Yeah.
Now, is there our time running short? Is there anything that I haven't asked that you would like to be sure to include?
Wow. I made a lot of notes before knowing we were going to talk, and I think we've gone through most everything. You know, it's a fun job. It can be a lot of fun. There's a lot of opportunity to help people understand things, and that's part of the fun for me. But just being in pro ball and getting paid as a league official, that's a blast for me. You know, it's so much fun, and I having the respect of people around me doing the job is very nice. And, you know, it's something good that makes me smile that I can walk away from a ball game most nights and think, well, that's a good night, you know. Every once in a while, there's not one of those nights, but most nights, most of the time. So,
I'd like to thank David Vincent for taking time to speak with me for this Society for American Baseball Research oral history interview, and for taking about 90 minutes of your time.
I appreciate the you coming out to talk to me. Yeah. Thanks, John.